All right, we're ready to go, I think. Grab your quiz up here if you haven't gotten it yet. Three left. I have them. I have the scores entered in the gradebook in D12, and I have the answer key for the quiz in D12 as well. So the way I do it, I have an answer key, and I put up a blank version of it on there. So you can look over the answer key, but what you can do is print the blank version out and use that as another practice to see if what you know now you'll do better on it. So if you didn't quite know what you were doing on this quiz, that means you have a little more practicing to do, especially on unit conversions, making sure you can get units to cancel. A lot of the problems that I saw on this quiz were people that weren't effectively canceling their units from the top to the bottom and so on. So do extra practice with that. That'll help you with like all of our calculations throughout this course, seriously. So you have a Chapter 2 assignment due this Friday. So please be working on that. Prepare your book for the limiting reactant slab next week. You have a written report for Experiment 2 that's due on Tuesday. The lab page has report guidelines, so go through that, right, reading about what each section should contain. There is a sample lab report on the lab webpage, the same place you get the experiments, so read through that to get a feel for how the format and tone should be.
That's one lab report per group, right?
Yeah, you worked in pairs, so work together to do the lab report, and then just one of you in the pair submits it. On the submission guidelines that I gave you that first time, I said that it's important that when you're submitting for a pair, that when you're in D2L and you do the submit, there's a comments box. So put your name and your partner's name in that comments box. That helps me quickly see who was involved in that. So only one of you needs to submit it, but make sure you have both your names in that comments box. That make sense, everybody? Okay. I think that's about it. Any other questions before we move on? Alrighty. So we got a quick intro last time to Chapter 3. We talked about the difference between compounds and mixtures. We've seen this flowchart before for classifying matter. Remember, there are this is actually half of that flowchart. Okay? What we saw before was pure substances on one side and mixtures on the other side. So here are pure substances. So we learned before that pure substances can be elements or compounds. Well, now let's sort of break elements and compounds up a little bit. There are atomic elements and molecular elements. So take a look. Let's start with atomic elements. Neon is an example of an atomic element, and oxygen, O2, is an example of a molecular element. What's the difference between those two? Yes. For the atomic elements, we have individual atoms. And we'll come back to these here in just a second. With molecular, look at this picture here. There's two oxygen atoms stuck together to make a single oxygen molecule. So when you have groups of atoms that are stuck together like that, that makes molecules. So molecular elements exist as groups of bonded atoms. All right. So, coming back to these atomic elements, neon is an example here, and neon in its pure form, in its standard state, is a gas. So, many atomic elements are gases, where we have just individual atoms that are very far apart. We saw that atomic view of gases before, that the particles that make it up are very far apart from each other, and they essentially don't interact with each other, right? So other atomic elements, though, are solids, usually metallic. Metallic solids are made of stacked atoms. They're atoms, they're all stacked together, but the individual units of them are still just the individual atoms themselves. The smallest bit that still is that substance is just one of the atoms, but they're stacked together to make a solid. So pure metals, things like gold and pure iron and silver and sodium and things like that, aluminum, those are atomic elements because there's just individual atoms that happen to all be stacked together to make the solid. Yeah.
Is that an individual property? Like, is it interchangeable sometimes with iron and oxygen, just one, or is it always oxygen?
Oxygen itself is very unstable as an individual atom. So as we go through bonding and as we learn a little more about that, we'll see why that is. So metals can exist in a stable form on their own, just all stacked together in a big solid. Neon, right? It's in the right-hand column of the periodic table, the noble gases. So those exist as individual atoms because they're stable on their own. They don't need to join with anything else. So other things, though, form molecules in order to be stable. So there are a couple types of molecular elements. There are a particular number of diatomic elements. What does diatomic mean? Two atoms, right? Pairs of covalently bonded atoms. And what happens in a covalent bond? What have electrons done? Yeah, electrons are shared between atoms. So we said that last time. So in a diatomic element, we have atoms that exist in pairs, just like these oxygens. So turns out there are 7 diatomic elements. There are H2, N2, O2, F2, Cl2, Br2, and I2. And it's not just 7 random elements that we've arranged here. Let me go back and show you our periodic table here. There we go. It's a different color here. Again, hydrogen is sort of off on its own. Okay? It exists as pairs of atoms. The other ones are over here on this right side. So nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine. So a way to remember that, as long as you remember hydrogen, then the other ones sort of form a number 7 over here that reminds you that there are actually 7 of them. So as long as you start with nitrogen, and then you go down the halogens, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine, those are the 7 diatomic elements. So whenever we have a pure sample of any of those elements, they'll exist as those pairs of atoms. So we'll always write their formula N2. Or O2, or F2, something like that, because that's the way they exist in their stablest form, right? So make sure you're able to identify those. That's something that'll pop up again and again for us in here. So beware of those 7 diatomic elements. There are a couple of elements that are polyatomic. What does that mean? Yeah, many. Multiple atoms. So sort of like covalently, sort of like diatomic, except there's more than 2. So P4 is one of them. S8 is another one. Phosphorus mainly exists as molecules where we have 4 atoms that have been bonded together in a neat little compact shape. Sulfur, one of the solid forms of sulfur, are these S8 molecules. And they're actually kind of neat. They actually form a chain, a ring of 8 sulfur atoms that's sort of puckered here. See if I can draw it. Something like that. This one. So if you looked down on it, it would look like a ring, but looking at it from the side, it's sort of going up and down like that. So interesting structure. But sulfur actually has several different solid forms depending on how it was prepared. If you take liquid sulfur and you cool it really fast, it makes one form. If you let it cool slowly on its own, it's another form. If you deposit it from a gas, it's another form, and so on. So this is just one of the forms. So just something to be aware of. Let's move on to the types of compounds there are. So looking at our flowchart that we had before, we had atomic elements and molecular elements based on whether it's just one atom or multiple atoms grouped together. But in elements, right, what's the main difference between elements and compounds? Yeah, only one type of atom per element. Okay? They can be arranged differently, they can be grouped together, but they only come from one place on the periodic table. With compounds, we have two or more elements that are combined together. But in one compound, what did we say about the ratio of elements in a compound? What's that? Yeah, it's always the same. In one compound, there's a fixed exact ratio of atoms that defines that particular compound. So molecular compounds, one type of compound, we have two or more covalently bonded non-metals. Look at that. That's there. Grouped as molecules. In order for something to be made of molecules, its atoms must be non-metals. Where were non-metals at on the periodic table? Yeah. Way up on the right-hand corner. Remember the diagonal staircase? The ones up in the right-hand corner. Those were the non-metals. Plus, what's the other one non-metal? Hydrogen. It's in the upper left corner. But non-metals will group together with each other to make molecules. They'll do that by covalent bonds, so they'll share their electrons to make very strong bonds between them. The molecular formula tells us the exact number of atoms per molecule. If we're looking at one of those little groups, just counting up how many atoms of each element are in a molecule. So H2O specifically is telling us that in a water molecule there are 2 hydrogens and 1 oxygen, so on. O2 is a molecular formula because within an oxygen molecule there are 2 oxygen atoms that have been bonded together. C6H6 is benzene, a substance that used to be used an awful lot as a solvent until they figured out just how terribly carcinogenic it is. Just an awful substance in terms of cancer. But its molecular formula is C6H6. It has molecules that have 6 carbons and 6 hydrogens in them, in a certain grouping. So that's what a molecular formula is. It's an exact count itself. So empirical formula, though, is the simplest ratio of atoms in a compound. So no longer just talking specifically about what the molecules are. At the entire compound, what is the ratio of one element to another? So what's the empirical formula for H2O? Yeah, that one's the same, right? It is a 2-to-1 ratio of hydrogen to oxygen. So empirical formula, we'll write it the same way, right, with the subscripts. One is never written as a subscript. If there's no subscript, we assume that means one. Right. What's the empirical formula for O2? oh, put quotes around it, because only one element, right, for every elemental substance, whether it's molecular or atomic, every element has just one as its, has just one element as its empirical formula. What's the empirical formula of benzene?
CH.
Which just shows a 1-to-1 ratio. Okay. If I had C6H9 as a molecular formula, what would that empirical formula be? What's that ratio reduced to? Yeah, reduces to 2-to-3. So, using whatever that is, the least common multiple or something of those numbers to reduce the ratio. So that's the empirical formula. And this is important because later on in this chapter, a certain calculation will only be able to give us an empirical formula of a substance. And we might have to do something else to figure out what an actual molecular formula is. So, structural formulas themselves show us how atoms are bonded together. And we generally draw lines to represent covalent bonds. So in an H2O molecule, structural formula will look something like this. Later on, we'll deal with the details for where all the electrons are and what shape they are and stuff like that. But for now, let's just say there's two hydrogens attached to an oxygen. In O2, we have two oxygens that actually have two lines between them. And we'll talk all about that later in the bonding chapter. It's called the double bond. And there's actually two pairs of electrons that are shared in there. So I better show you the structure of benzene because it's kind of interesting. I'm going to draw six carbons in a hexagon. And I'm going to alternate double and single bonds between them. Then each carbon gets one hydrogen. So, a very interesting structure, and it took chemists an awful long time after they started figuring out what molecules were made of. It took them a long time to figure out what the actual structure of benzene was. It was a major revelation for one person in particular to imagine that the carbons can bond over in a ring so that the end of the chain can be bonded back into itself like that. So it's a very common structural element of a lot of molecules, it turns out. So, but the molecular formula is most closely related to the structural formula because if we counted up the atoms in this, that would give us the molecular formula. Does that make sense, everybody? Great. Ionic compounds. Okay. So there were two types of compounds on our flowchart. There were molecular and ionic. What type of elements did I just say that molecular compounds have to be made of? Non-metals only. All right. Ionic compounds are made from a lattice of positively and negatively charged ions. So, I've got a picture of some salt crystals here. What NaCl, what sodium chloride is actually made up of is, this is called an ionic lattice, just like we said up there. Where we have alternating ions, so positive, negative, and so on, all stacked together to make the, and that goes out in three dimensions to make a salt crystal like that. And the actual structure of the crystals is related in some way to how those ions, to the patterns that those ions stack themselves together in. So another example where atomic properties can make for actual properties that we can see themselves. It's no accident that that ionic lattice is the same shape as salt crystals looked at through a microscope. So let's talk about what sodium chloride actually is. So, sodium chloride, NaCl, sodium chloride, the formula unit of an ionic compound is whatever collection of atoms gives us it's whatever gives us the smallest neutral collection of ions. So I've got positive ions here. I have Na plus ions. I have Cl minus ions. So we've talked before about how ions form. What did sodium have to do in order to get its positive charge? Yeah, had to lose one electron, and where did that one electron go? To chloride, yeah. So there was that transfer of electrons that made them these charges. So I have this pair now of two ions. Taken together, what is the charge of that pair of ions?
Neutral.
Yeah, that's a neutral grouping. So that is the formula, NaCl. Is the formula unit here. So when we have a formula written out, something like NaCl, right, just a single sodium and a single chloride makes up that grouping that we consider to be the unit of an ionic compound. It's different from molecular compounds in that there's not an NaCl here, and then an NaCl here, then an NaCl here. They're all stacked together like that, but the best we can do to make a unit out of that would be to pick, say, two of those that make a neutral pair. So we can think of ionic compounds as many, many formula units that way. Does that make sense? So formula unit is not something that actually is grouped together. It's just our way of grouping them together so we can see what the simplest unit is of that whole ionic lattice. Right? Yeah.
Is the formula unit always neutral?
Yeah, formula unit's smallest neutral collection of ions. Yeah. So, the thing is, though, not all ions are just a single plus and a single minus. So if I had a 2 plus, I'd need two negatives along with it as the formula unit. So we'll get to that in a second. A polyatomic ion is still an ion. It's still a particle that carries a charge, but that ion just happens to have two or more atoms to it. So it is a molecule in our definition of molecules as a grouping of atoms that acts as a unit, but that grouping of atoms will carry a charge, meaning that whole grouping will have gained an electron or will have given an electron away. So polyatomic ions act as ions do, so you can have a polyatomic ion stacked next to another ion, so you'll still have ions stacked together. So anytime there are charges like this, we'll still have an ionic compound, right? So, for instance, SO4 2 minus. Let's look at that formula there. How many atoms are contained within that polyatomic ion? Yeah, one sulfur and four oxygens. So that's what that tells us. There's one sulfur, there's four oxygens. What does this 2 minus mean that I've put up above here? Yeah, it has a 2 minus charge, right? The whole thing . So we can really sort of think of it like this, where that's the grouping of atoms that exist together, and that whole grouping has a 2 minus charge to it. Okay? So polyatomic ions like this will form ionic compounds with an oppositely charged ion. It'll be impossible for me to have a pure sample of SO4 2 minus. Because compounds themselves have to be neutral overall as we'll see. So this is going to form an ionic compound that'll look pretty similar to one like this, except instead of one sphere like this, there's going to be a grouping of atoms that's made a molecule. But still, that ion will be next to an oppositely charged ion, and that'll be next to another ion like this. So, for instance, this sulfate ion, if I had a compound with sodium and SO4-2-, if I wanted to have a neutral compound, what ratio of those two ions would I need? Yeah, I would need a 2-to-1 ratio. So the formula unit of this compound would be Na2SO4. So two of those sodium ions, one SO4-2 ion.
What is SO4?
SO4 is sulfate. So we'll see, we'll get our whole list of polyatomic ions here in a few minutes. All right? So let's keep going with that idea. Let's talk about how ionic compounds form, how we can predict what their formula units will be. So how we can predict which ratio of atoms will be involved in their makeup. So ionic compounds always have positive and negative ions. Ionic compounds are always charge neutral overall. So within one formula unit, all of the plus charges must cancel all of the minus charges. That's why I didn't show any charges here in this formula unit. All of the charges have canceled out, and we're just left with two sodiums for every SO4 unit. So the plus and minus charges must cancel. And then we'll show the simplest whole number ratio of ions in the formula. There's no such thing as like a molecular formula where we're counting an actual number of things because we have that ionic lattice. All we have is a certain ratio of ions that's been stacked up all together. So it's always expressed in its simplest whole number ratio. So let me introduce you to this concept of an ion pair. That's just listing what the positive ion is and what the minus ion is. So with their charges. So in the formula NaCl, what is the positive ion? Na plus, right? The negative ion is Cl minus. We learned earlier that metals make positive ions, nonmetals make negative ions. So remind ourselves of that. There's the metal. There's the nonmetal. Okay? For a compound made of calcium and chlorine, in order to figure out what ratio of those we'll need, we need to consult our periodic table to see what charged ions those will make. Right? So calcium and chlorine. Here's calcium. See if you can write down on your paper what charge of an ion you think calcium will make. First ask yourself, is it going to gain electrons? Is it going to lose electrons? And then chlorine. It's over here. Ask yourself, is chlorine going to gain electrons or lose electrons? And what its charge will be. So, when we want to figure out what kind of ionic compound will be made, first, let's write an ion pair. What did you say for calcium? What charge will calcium make? Okay. Chlorine will make what charge? L minus. That chlorine's in group 7, so it just needs one more electron to get over to the noble gases there. That's the ion pair. Ionic compounds must be charge neutral overall. So we need what ratio of those ions to have a neutral compound? 1 to 2. Is there a simple way you could tell that it's a 1 to 2 ratio based on those charges? I have a 2 plus and a 1 minus charge. What can I do to those numbers to get a 1 to 2 ratio? Yeah, I can switch them. And that's just a little bit of algebra that we're sidestepping. If something has a large charge, we will need fewer of them. If something has a small charge, we'll need more of them in order for all the pluses and the minuses to balance. So if I have a 2 plus charge and a 1 minus charge, those numbers get swapped in order to give us an idea of the ratio of each of those that we'll need. Okay? So if we need a 1 to 2 ratio, then what will the formula unit of calcium, of this compound formed between calcium and chlorine, what will that formula unit look like? Yep. 1 calcium, 2 chlorines. There. So, really what happened, this number 2 switch to over there. The 1 got put over there. Cross those charge numbers over to figure out what the formula was going to be. All right? So I have 2 others on here. I'm going to write 2 more of them on here. A plus and PO4 3 minus, Al3 plus, and NO3 minus. I'm just going to change this quickly. I used to always use that slash for an ion pair, now I just use a comma. It's just a little more clear. So ignore that slash. So what I'd like you to do is take these given ion pairs and figure out what ionic formula will form from them. Okay, so let's do groups.
I think we're already sort of arranged. We can do 1, 2, 3, 4. So that works. So
1, 2, 3, 4. Get the 4 ionic formulas written out, remembering the sort of rules of thumb we had at the top of the page, that it has to be neutral overall. And then it has to show the simplest ratio of elements. So get those 4 written down and compare them with your group members. So it should only take that. It should only take a minute. Comparing. Yeah. Let me move up a row. Back row. Thank you. Remembering in polyatomic ions that those atoms exist as a group. Nothing changes inside of that polyatomic ion there. So this is one ion there itself.
Guaranteed way to not get it confused.
Alrighty. Let's...
let's start with the people in the back middle.
What ratio of ions do you need in order for iron 3 plus and O2 minus to be neutral? 2 to 3? So, what's the formula of that compound? 2 or 3. Good. Easy one. All right. Over here to my right, you folks. What ratio of calcium 2 plus and SO4 2 minus do you need? You need a 1 to 1 ratio. So, what formula shows a 1 to 1 ratio of those two ions? Ca? Ca what? CaSO? CaSO4. Common mistake number one. CaSO4 is a 1 to 1 ratio, not a 1 to 4 ratio. Why? What is that 4 part of? What's that 4 part of? Yeah. Part of the polyatomic ion. It's part of this grouping that never changes. As long as we have that ion present, okay, then there are four oxygens for every one sulfur within that ion itself. Does that make sense, everybody? That's a major misconception we're going to take care of right away. Okay. Down in front here, what ratio of Na plus and PO4 3 minus do you need? What is that?
3 to 1.
Okay. So, formula, Na. Looks good. Okay. Over here in the front, what ratio do we need?
1 to 3.
1 to what?
3.
1 to 3. Okay. So, we'll figure out how to do this one?
Sure.
Sure, you did. Al what?
NO3 in parentheses.
Ah, NO3 in parentheses.
The outside.
Whenever I need to show more than one, when my ratio of a polyatomic ion is more than one, I put parentheses around it and put how many of them I need. That's going to be very important to us because... what's the ratio on the compound up on top there that I just wrote? What's the ratio on the compound on the bottom?
1 to 3.
What has to be different about iron in order for each of these compounds to be neutral? Charges? Charges have to be different. Okay. So we'll come back to that. We'll deal with that later. But ClO3 is one polyatomic ion. ClO is a different polyatomic ion. Okay? So, that's just a sidebar in dealing with ratios. So, everybody good with that so far? Good with parentheses and that sort of business? Starting with ions, the numbers get swapped to make a ratio. And that tells us... I sort of swapped the numbers here, but 2 to 2 got reduced to 1 to 1 because the ratio is always the simplest. Right? So, let's take what we learned with that and give names to ionic compounds. We had to do that business with ions and ion pairs and ratios and so on because ionic compounds are named based on their ions themselves. So, whatever the plus charge and the minus charge is, that's important for the name of ionic compounds. So, first of all, naming ionic compounds. One, is it an ionic compound? How do we know? Say I have two atoms, right? Atom A and atom B. What do those two atoms have to be in order for it to be an ionic compound?
Positive and negative.
Positive and negative? What part of the periodic tables, what parts of the periodic table do they have to come from in order to be a positive and negative? Metal and a non-metal, right?
That's correct.
So, what I'll write here, the positive and negative charges, or some variation, 2 plus and minus, or plus and 3 minus, or something like that, that have been balanced out. But if it is binary, which means just two elements, we have to have a metal and a non-metal. If there are more than two elements involved in an ionic compound, what does one of the ions have to be, at least? Take a look here. In that formula, and that formula, and that formula, we have more than two elements. So, what does that mean about one of the ions, at least? Well, not necessarily a metal. Here's an ionic compound. Yeah, if there's more than two elements, there has to be at least one polyatomic ion. So binary or contains polyatomic ion or ions. Okay. All right. So we've identified a compound. It has, say, a metal and a non-metal, or we see maybe a metal and a polyatomic ion or something like that. Okay. Does the metal have fixed charge or variable charge? So far, we've dealt with metals in sort of group 1 and group 2, maybe group 3. Okay. And we figured out how to always get their charges. Sodium always has a plus charge because it's in group 1 over here, and it always just loses one electron. Calcium, we saw on the last page, loses two electrons. Okay. There are other metals, though, that have variable charges. So here's our official definition. Fixed charge metals are group 1A, group 2A, plus these three. So let me draw them on a periodic table here. There we go. So, running out of colors here. So, group 1A. All the metals in group 1A here, so lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, what charge will they all have? Yeah, single plus. Okay. Not hydrogen. Hydrogen's a non-metal. Okay. Group 2A, what will they all be?
2 plus.
2 plus. All right. So, those are fixed charge. Those are fixed charge. In every example we will see in this course, when they make ions, they'll also always be 1 plus or 2 plus. The rest of them, right, the other ones, aluminum, 3 plus, zinc, 2 plus, silver, plus. Those are handy for us because they exist all together in that diagonal. Well, francium and radium are radioactive and only naturally occurring for a small amount of time, so they don't really form compounds too much. So we don't worry about them. Okay. So figure out. So fixed charges. There's a limited number of memorization tasks for you to do in this course. We'll be giving you some polyatomic ions that you have to memorize, but this is sort of a memorization task. Okay? Group 1A are pluses, group 2A are 2 pluses, aluminum, zinc, and silver are 3 plus, 2 plus, and 1 plus. Okay? Those are the ones that we can count on for always having that charge in every compound they make. Okay? So every other metal, so including the transition metals, including these main group metals over here that are below aluminum, okay, including metalloids that are on the metal side, So when we're talking about ions, when we're talking about compounds, we're going to not worry about metalloids really anymore. Things on the right-hand side of this dividing line will act like nonmetals. Things on the left will act like metals, at least for naming compounds. This is that goes. Okay? So all of these other metals can have variable charge, which means in different compounds, any one of those metals could have different charges. So iron, for instance, here, let's go back to my thing here. So, for instance, iron makes Fe2+ in some compounds, Fe3+ in other compounds. Copper makes 1+ in some and 2+ in others, and so on. So something like manganese makes several different charges, 1+, 2+, 4+, 6+, things like that. There's no need to memorize a large number of charges. The only thing you need to know are the fixed ones and that everything else can have multiple charges. Okay? That good? So we ask ourselves, does the metal have a fixed charge or a variable charge? Three, I'll write the ion pair. If a metal is a variable charge, we have to figure out what charge it is based on the formula. So let me give you a simple example. If I have a formula FeCl3, well, iron is one of those variable charged metals, so I'll draw a box there because we don't know what its charge is. But chlorine always has what charge? It's in group 7. It's just one away from the noble gases. Yeah, chlorine always has a negative charge. So in the compound FeCl3, in order for that compound to be neutral, what must iron's charge be? Think about it. If I have 3 chlorines, I have 1 iron. Iron must be 3+. That's a simple example. We can tell based on this formula because the nonmetals always form fixed charges. We can predict what charge the nonmetal will make just by seeing how many skips it takes to get over to the noble gases like we've done before in here. We can tell from this formula because there are 3 of those Cls that iron has to be 3+. Does that make sense? We'll get plenty of practice doing this, don't worry. All right. Naming of an ionic compound comes from the name of the positive ion and the name of the negative ion. You cannot name an ionic compound just from its formula. Okay? You have to figure out what the plus is and what the minus is. Then the name of the plus and the name of the minus tells us how ionic compounds are named. So, fixed charge metals, and I think we talked about cations before. What charge does a cation have?
Plus,
okay. So fixed charge metal cations are just named the same as the element. So the Na plus ion is called what?
Sodium.
Easy. The Ag plus ion is called what?
Silver.
Okay. So naming of compounds, going back and forth between formulas and names, does require that we know the symbols and names for some common elements. So, what I will show you here, it's going to make me log in. I'll show you something on my webpage here. Oh. 1061. Handouts, here we go. Elements to be memorized. Right there. Especially if it's been a while since you've taken a chemistry class, this will be something important to you. If you've taken any kind of chemistry class recently, I'm sure you'll probably know almost all of these, but it's still good to review up on them. So if it's been a while, you might want to make flashcards out of these because it's It's really important that we, you know, and the language of chemistry has really two forms, writing out elements as their symbols and then writing out names of compounds with actual words. And they're completely synonymous, but we have to know that that Mn is manganese and Mg is magnesium, for instance. Those are two very different elements, and you could get yourself into a lot of trouble if you read Mn on paper and then go get a bottle that says magnesium, right? So there are a lot of little hints that help you, though, right? Look at the first and third letter of each of these. Mg, magnesium. Mn, manganese. So that's always a good one that helps. I almost hesitate pointing this out because then it gets stuck in people's head. So I almost hesitate. But be careful with the spelling of fluorine. It's F-L-U, like H1N1. Right? So put flu first, and then O-R-I-N-E. It's the same root as fluorescent lights, and for the longest time, it was actually Target that had a aisle, their aisle that said fluorescent lights on the big marker had it spelled wrong, and it was that way all over the country for probably 10 years or something like that until somebody figured it out. So, I have in parentheses the old names that a lot of these symbols came from. So sodium used to be called natrium. That's why its symbol is Na. But I will not accept natrium as the name of that element because it's called sodium. Now, I just put that for your benefit so you'll know what it's called. In some places in Europe, they do still call tungsten wolfram, but we call it tungsten here in the U.S. So, anyway, print that page out, use that for reference. It's going to be important that you can go back and forth between names and symbols of elements if we're going to be successful in naming compounds and going from names to formulas. Right? So, we were at fixed charge elements, right? Fixed charge metal cations, right? Just the name of the element. Variable charge metal cations will use a Roman numeral to show their charge. So, what's Fe?
Iron.
Fe with the 2 plus is called what? Iron 2. Yeah. So Fe 3 plus is iron 3. Okay. And I was pretty careful about how I wrote that. There is no space between the word iron, the parentheses, the two capital I's for the Roman numeral, and the closed parentheses. So within this word right here, there's no space. All right. So anytime we have variable charge, we have to say what charge it is with those Roman numerals. That's what that Roman numeral is. Non-metal anions that are monoatomic. What does monoatomic mean? Yeah, a single atom. So if I have a single atom that's made a minus charge from a non-metal, the name of that is an element root plus ide. So we already decided that Cl makes a minus charge, so what's the name of that ion? We all know that one. That's chloride. That's why table salt is sodium chloride and not sodium chlorine. Chlorine is actually Cl2, a pure diatomic element. Sodium chloride has a Cl minus ion that's combined with sodium to make a compound. So nonmetals in compounds will always have ide at the end of their name. So what's the N3 minus ion called? It's the root of that element is NITR. So, nitride. So, sulfur makes a 2- ion that is called what? Sulfide. In the U.S., we have an F there. In Great Britain and Europe, they have a pH there. So we have an F there in the U.S. P3 minus is what? Phosphide. There is a pH in phosphide because the element phosphorus has pH in it. Yeah. So, and it goes that way for all of the nonmetals. So there's oxide and nitride and chloride and bromide and fluoride and iodide and selenide and so on. So all of those nonmetals up there that make minus charges have a name that ends in "-ide," that way. So we've got the pieces now that we need to name pretty much any ionic compound, okay? Given what the name of the positive ion is, and then what the name of the negative ion is. So, let's do one of each together, and then I'll set you in your groups to do the rest of it. So, let's do this. Let's actually do the middle one, right here, because that's a little tougher. I'll let you guys together do the top one and the bottom one of these. Okay. So, nickel, Ni, is that a fixed charge or a variable charge metal? Variable charge. So, the ion pair will have Ni with some charge that we don't quite know yet. The minus ion is what? Cl minus. What was the ratio in this compound, though? This compound, how many nickels for how many chlorines? What is it? 1 to 2. Formula tells us the ratio itself. What does that mean about nickel's charge?
Plus.
Plus? 2+. Right? Nickel has to be 2+ because there's one of them that has to balance out 2 chlorides. That whole thing is neutral. Sort of think of it like that. The amount of these came from the ratio. The charge of that nickel we had to figure out. So, what is the name of the Ni ion with the 2+ charge? Nickel? Nickel, 2. Okay, that's the first word. What's the second word? Chloride. Okay. So, starting with the formula, we have to get the positive ion and the negative ion. The name comes from that. Let's start with this name down here on the bottom. It's usually a little simpler starting with the name than it is starting with the formula. And I'm going to repair that so that the spacing is correct. Vanadium 1 oxide. And the spacing is that way on purpose to tell you that 1 is associated with vanadium and not oxide. So, vanadium's just V, but what's its charge? Single plus. How do we know that? Right here. That is its charge. When we've given you the name of a variable charge metal compound, we had to tell you what the charge was right there. That's the charge. Look on your periodic table. What is oxide? Okay. If that's the ion pair, what's the formula? Okay. So, complete the rest of these. CaO, WS3, silver nitride, and calcium phosphide. And just a few minutes before we finish, we'll convene and see if we all agree. Okay? Anybody got a periodic table somewhere that you can look at?
Somebody next to you or something?
All right, let's share. It's okay if you're not quite finished. We'll get there. Let's start with you folks over here. What's the positive ion for the first one? Calcium, what charge? 2 positive. O, what? 2 negative. Name? That one's easy. Why not calcium 2 oxide? Yeah, it's fixed charge. Fixed charge, there's no need to have the 2 there because calcium is always 2 plus. Make sense? Calcium oxide. Alrighty. What do we got here? WS3. This one's a little tougher. Tungsten. Is tungsten fixed charge or variable charge? Let's go down here with you folks. Tungsten's variable, so I don't know what that is yet. What charge does sulfur have? What is it? 2 negative? What's the ratio in this formula? 1 to 3. We have a 1 to 3 formula of some positive ion and 3 2 minus ions. So what's the positive charge on tungsten? 6 plus. Be careful. You can't just take this number down here and bring that up and call that the charge. You always have to make sure that you've written the correct negative charge and that your positive charge here, considering this ratio, will make a neutral compound. Does everybody understand how a 1 to 3 ratio of these two ions makes a neutral compound? Okay, that's important. So, tungsten what? 6, how do I write 6? B? I. 5 plus 1, right? Tungsten 6, what? Good. All right, starting with names now. Back to my left, silver nitride. What's the positive ion? What letters? Ag, what? Plus. Silver's fixed at plus charge, right? What is nitride? And what is it? Okay. Formula of this compound is what? Good. Back in the middle, calcium phosphide. Ca what? P3 minus. Okay. Formula?
Ca3P2.
Yeah. When you have the charges, you can cross them over and make sure it's the simplest ratio. But for all of these, you can always check your work by making sure that the compound you've made is neutral. Okay? One way of checking, for instance, this last one would be saying 3 calcium, 2 plus ions makes how much charge total?
6 plus.
And 2 phosphide ions makes how much charge total?
6 minus.
It's minus, so. That's what makes it a neutral compound overall. Okay? Good with that? Just before we go, let me show you our page of polyatomic ions. We've already said what polyatomic ions are, a group of atoms that acts as a unit but has a certain charge to it. So, let me just point out a couple of things on here because you will need to have these memorized in order to be effective in converting names to formulas, formulas to names. Okay? The only positive one you need to know right now is ammonium. What is ammonia? Anybody know what ammonia is? NH3. So, don't confuse that with the ammonium ion, which is NH4 with a plus charge. Okay? So that's the only plus one on the list. Notice there's not any particular pattern other than if we look at these ones, phosphate has the same charge. As phosphide and sulfite, or I'm sorry, sulfate here has the same charge as S2 minus. So that's at least helpful for those ones. For phosphorus and sulfur, If you had an individual P, it would be P3 minus. Here I have PO4, it has the same charge. Okay. Here I have SO4, that has the same charge. But that works for those ones, it doesn't work for the nitrogen, because an individual nitrogen has what charge? Yeah, has a 3 minus. So here nitrate has just a 1 minus charge. Okay. So one thing I will show you is that removing one oxygen changes the ending from 8 to ite. Okay. And that will work with most of these. So NO2 minus is called what? Nope. Yeah. That is the nitrite ion. Nitrous oxide is a neutral compound that is N2O. But even so, this has a minus charge. So anything with a minus charge will be an ide or an ate or an ite, like that. Okay? So PO3, 3 minus, is called what? ClO, where is it? ClO2 with a minus charge, called what?
Chloride.
NO2, oh, we already did that one. SO3. SO3 2 minus is what?
Sulfite.
Okay. So, if you know all the 8s, just removing an oxygen but keeping the charge the same turns those 8s into an ite. So that reduces the total amount of information that you need to memorize. The ones I have written over here are sort of a minimum set that you can use to figure out others from. So I would actually recommend making flashcards out of these. Even if you've had chemistry recently, it'll be good to review these. Okay, so understanding the formula, how many oxygens, and the charge, those are all equally important for these. So I'll get some flashcards made and start up on those right away. But we'll talk more about these. We'll use them in compounds. We'll talk about more of the variations and so on starting next time. Ready? So have a good weekend. Get your homework done for Friday. We'll see you on Monday.